Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning and Music at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and Theologian in Residence of Canvas Community in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
Today we read from the Markan Apocalypse, Mark chapter 13. We'll read verses 1 through 8 and then 24 to 37. It's a vision of the thorough undoing of the world as we have come to know it. The most grand of buildings will fall. The weather patterns that sustain our food and water will falter. Even heaven and earth will not endure. My persistent question reading these texts was, for better and for worse, what do people do when they think the world is going to end? And how can this knowledge root us in the teachings of the Torah or the word of Jesus without prompting us to shrink back from a world that still needs us? Thanks for being with us. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Amy. How was your thing?
My thing was so good. My thing was a concert, in case people didn't hear
that. I should have been more
whining
specific.
About the concert prep for the last two episodes.
It went well.
Yeah, it was really fun, and all the big feelings, laughter, crying, all the things.
Oh.
We like to really pull on people's emotions.
Yeah.
You're gonna feel all the things.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah, no, it's
beautiful.
Really good. And I had a little follow-up, you know, meeting this morning with my ensemble to just sort of debrief. And then I told them afterwards, like, okay, I have to go record a podcast on the Markan Apocalypse. And they are Jewish. And so the word Markan is not really like a word. I don't know if it really is a word. But they thought I said Martian Apocalypse.
Whoa, that's
And they were
exciting.
Like, wow, that's a cool podcast. Tell us more.
I'm like, well, there's about Jesus coming on a cloud.
That is kind of Mark, you know.
Yeah.
It says son of man. It could be son of.
That's true.
A Martian.
A Martian man.
Yeah. We're really getting into dangerous territory.
We
I'm
probably
just going to
start
talking about this.
Markan is, in fact, a word, but it reminds me of one of my favorite stories that you tell from time to time about once when you were talking about the Gospels for some reason with your Jewish community a long time ago.
I was teaching a class at the JCC, the Jewish Community Center, and I don't know why we were talking about the Gospels.
And they thought they got it confused and said it was the Gospel of Mike.
The guy kept referring to the Gospel of Mike, and I kept saying there's not a Gospel of Mike. He was really insistent in like a pretty thick Jersey accent.
Yeah.
But there was a Gospel of Mike.
Oh, so it wasn't just that he misspoke. It's that he didn't take the correction.
No, I think he really was committed.
I mean, fair enough. Like, I'm sure I have things that I'm committed to.
The Gospel of Mike. Yeah,
I like it better. I think you should read in that voice, because that, like, you're from Long Island, right? So you got that in you somewhere.
Somewhere, it's in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bobby, today we pick up right where we left off in the Book of Mark, but the story changes.
It changes so much.
The tenor of things shifts.
Yes.
A little bit.
Oh my goodness.
The reading today is Mark chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. And then it skips us down to the end of the chapter, verses 24 to 37. We literally read right up to the verse before this.
Yes.
In our last episode. So I don't know that there's anything we need in terms of orientation, but do you think there's anything we need?
Well, I mean, I think I would just remind us that in a text that we have not yet read, because we're going to read it next week, Jesus came into Jerusalem in the two chapters earlier in chapter 11. Mm-hmm. In a strange little quirk of the Markan text, he goes to the temple and then he's like, it's too late in the day. So he goes home and then he comes back again. And so that the things we've been reading the last couple of weeks were Jesus at the temple in the final week of his life. And then this is still that. And so we're in the last week of Jesus's life. We're in Jerusalem. We're at the temple. We just had that kind of critique of the scribes as devouring the widow's homes, and that little bit that we talked about last time about the widow giving her last pennies to the temple. And then we pick up here in an apocalyptic shift that you do not see coming. Or at least I did not see coming.
No.
I mean, I did because I've read it a million times. Yeah. But yeah. If you imagine yourself as an original listener of the text, you do not expect that this is where we're headed necessarily.
Yeah.
I think I was mentioning at the end of last time that when we read this 4 years ago, I think we were just at the beginning of COVID. Like, I think we had just been told to stay in our houses. And so it's so interesting to think about, like, the end of the world, the apocalypse, and like how that's kind of constantly happening. But I digress.
Yeah. What a time, man.
Yes. And yet even still.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and dive in. I'm going to read this whole first 8 verses in one chunk, and then we'll have plenty of time to discuss.
Okay.
So I'm picking up in verse 1, reading from the NRSV. As he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see those great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs." Okay, let me just ask you how you read this first question that Jesus gets, because I think there are different ways to read it. One of the disciples is like a tourist.
Yes.
In the big city of Jerusalem. Yes. Like looking up at the big buildings and is like, "Look, Messiah." No, he says, "Look, teacher, look at the buildings."
Yes.
Do you read this as like sweet and innocent, or like they're like maybe he's trying to impress Jesus with the buildings, or like a reminder to us that these folks maybe aren't from Jerusalem? They haven't seen buildings like this before.
Yeah. I love that the Common English Bible has that disciple saying, "What awesome stones and buildings." And I think the word awesome kind of helps me there with the tone a little bit. When I was in college, like I grew up in small town South Carolina. And when I was in college at Clemson, the Honors College took a trip to New York, to Manhattan. And like, this is kind of like, that's sort of how I think about this disciple. As he grew up in Galilee, he's been around farming villages his whole life. Suddenly he's in the major metropolis that is the center of Jewish life. It's the, you know, it's the whole center of the region, and he's kind of overwhelmed by it. It's like looking at the Empire State Building or something, just seeing how tall the buildings in New York were for the first time and sort of overwhelmed. And I mean, in a really kind of sweet way, but in a, you know, like this is clearly monumental, enormous, and also there's a sense like this is really where it all happens, isn't it? And so there's that kind of, I think, all of that sort of caught up together with this guy from Galilee who's never seen such things. Is that how you read it?
I mean, I think that's a good reading. I love that Jesus's answer is not, "Those buildings are dumb."
Yeah.
Or those buildings don't matter.
Right.
I mean, kind of what he goes on to say is kind of those buildings don't matter. But that's not what he says.
Yes.
He does it in this sort of you know, what in the rabbinic world, I don't know if we would call this like Kal V'chomer, the heavy and the light, but like as much power as you see in these buildings, something bigger is coming. So like he's not going to wipe out the power you see in the buildings. He's using it as like the stepping stone to express this bigger thing.
And the bigger thing then is the power of God. Is that where you're
headed? Well, he doesn't say yet, but I guess.
It's interesting. I mean, the part of like, I've been trying to sort of figure out which way to hold my head when I read this text in terms of where is the destructive force going to come from? So if you think of it that way, I just want to pay attention to this as we read. But if you think of it that way, as God is going to destroy these buildings, then yes, I think it's a Kal V'chomer. Like you think this is power. Wait till you see the real power.
Yeah.
I've been toying with the possibility. I don't know if I'm toying with it or not, or if this is just like a legitimate, I don't know, that it's more about the frailty of human power. That even though this thing looks big and strong and powerful and essential, it can crumble in a minute. But not necessarily because God's going to do that. And in fact, if you read this in the context of Mark, the author of Mark, or the original community that's reading this gospel, not in the time of Jesus himself. And, you know, when we tell stories, like the way we refract our current experience through the story we tell is always present in some way. Then what this community is experiencing is actually the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans.
Yeah.
And so one can read this as saying, even though this thing looks so substantial, there are other forces in the world, not necessarily divine forces, that can make this crumble. It's not as substantial as it appears.
So maybe that is more, not as exaggerated as I was saying, but that reading is more, don't be impressed. Don't be so impressed by
them. Yeah. We were talking a little bit about COVID earlier, but I don't want to focus on COVID because whatever, that was 4 years ago. But I really did have something of this experience where it was like the world as I knew it ceased to function in a matter of weeks.
Yes.
In a way that it had never occurred to me was possible. My own reading of that was there was not really a theological component. Like, I don't think God was doing that. Right. And yet all of these structures, all these institutions that I thought just were, it turned out they were frail. They were, could be destroyed and much more quickly than I had ever imagined.
Yes. No, I think that's exactly right. That what seems so stable and immovable around us, that we set up our whole lives sort of around the idea that those things are stable and immovable. In fact, they are not.
And I think whichever way you read it, as God is going to do this, or this is the way human history works, the Romans are going to do this, where you end up is sort of in a similar place, which is this place that you've invested with power, or you have thought is a stable force, is not. And therefore, you got to find something else to center yourself. I think that holds true whatever agency we think is going to destroy the temple.
The text doesn't record the response of that
person
per se.
Yeah, it's true.
But then when it goes on, so the Mount of Olives, he kind of like went across the street, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like sitting in a park across the street from the temple. He's moved off the premises, but not so far.
Yes.
From the temple.
They're at a distance where you can kind of look upon the temple from a different vantage point.
Yeah. And then the disciples do have questions, but they don't seem surprised at all by what he said.
That's true.
Which when he was telling them about how he was going to suffer and die, they were like, well, at least Peter was like, no. You know, but for this, they're like, okay, when?
Yes.
When's it going down?
Oh, that's, what do you make of that, Amy?
Well, that's supposed to be my question.
I know. I saw it coming.
I mean, this is not, it's not surprising to the, you know, for people who are immersed in the Hebrew Bible, the idea that the world as we know it is going to fall apart is, that's all over the prophets. It is all over the prophets.
Yeah.
And I think my understanding is that this period of time in particular, there was a real sense of nearness to that time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a fair, do you think that's why they're not surprised? Or do you think they just have, Jesus says so many crazy things that now they just, they're like, you know, dispense with their emotions and get down to the tachlis, like the nuts and bolts of the thing.
Yeah. I think that sense that you've got there of there is an expectation that we are in some sort of transition point in history. Like the Messiah has arrived. They have named it as such. Jesus had said, yes. I think the apocalyptic expectations, as you were saying, in the first century were prevalent. Certainly in the Christian community or what becomes the Christian community, we see that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We even see that in rabbinical writings in this period, mm-hmm. that there was mm-hmm. an expectation. So I think all of that is right. The thing that's throwing me off a little bit is in my own assessment, that would not have included the destruction of the temple. It would have included the overthrow of the Romans and the mm-hmm. defeat of the Romans. And so mm-hmm. I'm a little puzzled by the implication that the temple is the thing that's going to be destroyed.
Well, I don't know if at this point, was he talking about the temple? He just says, look at what large stones and what large buildings. I thought he was just looking around.
Oh, that's true. As they were leaving the temple. So they could have been looking at the temple or they could have been
looking. Or they could be looking at the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I've mentioned in my weekly Torah study group, we've decided instead of just reading the five books of Moses, we're going to read the entire Tanakh. And so we're going chapter by chapter through the entire Hebrew Bible. And we're in the prophets. And I don't know this historical period as well as you do, Bobby, the time when this text is being written and read, first century, yeah. But the prophets' visions of destruction are considerably worse than just the buildings falling down.
Right.
And we'll get into some of that later. But the idea that there's going to be this moment of great chaos and violence in the streets and horror is all over the place.
Yes.
It's all over the place in the prophets. So I guess that's having those texts in my head, that's sort of how I read this, that they were like, yes, we know that's coming.
That's really helpful, Amy. And in those texts, of course, the way that punishment of Israel is going to take place is going to be the destruction of the temple, which is a critique of the way the temple is being managed in the time of, you know, Jeremiah and those prophets. And so you're exactly right. It makes sense that you could transpose that into now. And so then there's an inherent critique of the temple, which is not only in the Christian writings, but also we see it in the Dead Sea Scrolls and elsewhere, where the way the central religion is being practiced is seen as being not in keeping with the will of God, and therefore there's going to be this site of destruction. I can see that. By the time Mark is writing, I think it was clear enough what was happening, right? So part of what I'm struggling mm-hmm, with a little bit is mm-hmm. thinking like, okay, in the 30s when Jesus is
yes.
living, the 70s-ish when Mark is writing, those are
happens.
Very different
yes.
moments
yes.
in terms of
yes.
Roman
yes.
relations, I guess.
Yeah. So the disciples ask a question, when is this going to happen and what's going to be our sign? But that is not the question that Jesus doesn't answer it right away.
He does not.
Do you see a relationship between their question and his answer? Or do you think it's just they had this question and Jesus has something else to say and so said the other thing? Like I do sometimes when you ask me questions and I just talk about something else.
Yeah. It's a time-honored practice. Yes.
It is time-honored. Yes, indeed.
Here's the way I want to read that right now, is that the question that they ask is a little bit wrongheaded and a little bit dangerous. So if you're trying to figure out exactly when the apocalypse is happening, when the kingdom is arriving, then you are susceptible to all sorts of manipulations. And we see that in the history of apocalyptic movements throughout history, that if you try to time it and then you say, this is it, then you can get pulled into political causes, you can get pulled into religious extremisms that have really nothing to do with the actual arrival of the kingdom of heaven. And so I wonder if that's Jesus's warning is, when somebody comes and tells you this is the time, be careful, because the people are going to try to manipulate this sense of the end. They're going to try to pull you into their war. They're going to try to pull you into their cause. They're going to try to pull you into some sort of apocalyptic movement. And I think what he's going to end up saying is, you're going to know, right? When it happens, you're going to know. So you don't need to worry about when.
You don't need to worry about when.
I don't know though. What, you have thoughts about that?
I'm so taken by your answer that, like, I just scrawled in like the margin of the paper next to me, what do we do when we think the world is ending?
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting question just to hold for this whole text. Like, what, because they're going to ask later on, like, that was a question that came to my mind later on. Like, what is it they're supposed to do?
Right.
And what does it mean to intentionally like cut off your investment in the status quo? And it can open up lots of good things, but it can also open up all kinds of nonsense, as you're saying.
Yes. It's also so interesting in there, you know, like if you were looking at these things as signs, wars and reports of wars and kingdoms fighting against each other and earthquakes and famines, you would, like, the world has been constantly ending.
Yes.
Since before this text was written. And this is just the nature, it seems, of human societies, that these things are sort of always going on. I don't quite know what to do with that, other than, like, these sorts of things that happen are not themselves the end or the transition. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, how do you explain the long sweep of history?
Yeah.
You can't think that every crisis is the ultimate end, because something different has to happen.
Baba, you know what was so striking to me, and maybe it's a translational issue, but in verse 7, Jesus says, "When you hear of wars and rumor of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come."
Yes.
And it would have seemed to me like, when you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed, that means the end is coming. But there's a but there. As though the wars could mean something else entirely. The wars could mean the end wasn't coming, or that,
right.
Like, why would there be a disjunctive there?
Yeah. The CEB has it, but these things must happen, but this isn't the end yet.
Huh.
Amy, the way that I'm reading that is similar to something I was grappling after earlier, which is to say that the wars are not the mechanism of the entrance of the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God. And so the war is not the arrival of the Messiah. The war is a war. And so that's not it. And so don't get pulled into that. I read this as an anti-violence text, ironically. Which is to say, don't get swept up in the war that is the apocalyptic war at the end of time, because it's not. There's going to be wars. There's going to be rumors of wars, but that's not the end. That's the way I'm reading it.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
It does, that those things will be happening. But I mean, I almost hear what you're saying as, like, don't think that, like, you have to choose, if you choose the right side in the war, that by fighting you are somehow bringing about the kingdom of God, or getting yourself into the kingdom of God. Or it's more like chaos will erupt at this time. And one way that chaos will manifest is war. And one way it will manifest is famine. And yeah.
And the way that I read that is, these are the products of human civilization. Human civilization, the way we have constructed it, produces war and violence and natural devastation and famine. And those are human things. And so don't confuse those with godly things.
This line, nation will rise against nation, made me think of that line from Isaiah.
Yeah.
Lo yisagoy al goy cherev, no longer will nation raise up sword against nation. Yes. Like it's this hopeful, this hope for a time. And this, I feel like there is hope in this text, but it's not that hope. It's like, no, nation will rise up, will raise up sword against nation. That's actually what's going to happen.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I loved the NRSV translation of that verse 8 that ended with birth pangs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk a little? I forget exactly what the translation was, but you don't expect that's going to land on birthing. Or at least I was not expecting that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, there is this imagery in maybe Isaiah, it's in the prophets, but the idea that, you know, in order for something fundamentally new, a new order, a new reality, a new era to come into place, it's like a birth. Mm. And a birth is very violent and chaotic and painful and terrifying. And, you know, like I think, I mean, maybe not all births are like that, but I think we have most folks don't have a close up and personal experience with a lot of births, and they're like, it really is a life and death thing every time.
Yes.
And so this again sort of holds that, like, in order to get to the next thing, in order for there to be hope, there has to be this like enormous pressure cooker, mm-hmm. you know, that is going to press it into the world. And it is, and it's all the things. It is tenuous and violent and scary and painful. Mm-hmm. But birth is such a positive image, mm-hmm. you know? So it finally draws our minds a little more. Before this, we've been sitting mostly with the destruction.
Right.
And now it sort of says, you know, that's the beginning of the birth pangs. But as soon as you say birth pangs, your mind is on the other side of it.
Yes. Oh, that's such a lovely way to say that. All of that, what you're saying, and then to put it in a first century context in which there wasn't good medical care and there weren't, I mean, it really was in even a more amplified sense, a life and death moment. And you weren't sure in the middle of it. I mean, you're never sure, but imagining the sense of vulnerability and you don't really know whether this is going to come out to the good or to the bad. And so in the middle of all of this stuff that's happening that is being compared to the birthing process now, you might have moments where you really don't know which way it's going to go. And here's the promise. Mm-hmm. There is something new on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. I like, too, what you're saying about in order for something new to come into being, there has to be a falling apart of what is currently there, which I do not like to think about. I like to think about, like, let's just gently build a better society and it'll be lovely.
I know. That is not the vision here.
Mark does not think that.
No.
I will say that in the Common English Bible, there are no birth pangs. It just says, these are the beginnings of the sufferings associated with the end, which is much less.
Those are really different.
They're very different. It turns out that the word that's being used there in Greek is a word for suffering that is sometimes correlated to birth pangs, but not always. Mm. And so there's a little bit of an interpretive move. But I'm going with the NRSV on this one because I need for there to be hope of a birthright here and not just suffering that ends in the end.
Those are very different. Hi, y'all. It's Amy, one of your friendly co-hosts, and I want to tell you why Bible Worm is important. There's a Jewish tradition that Torah study is best done with a partner, a hevruta, we call it, someone who pushes you beyond where you would have gone on your own. Bobby was essentially my hevruta for 10 years of grad school, and I've never found a thought partner quite like him. So when he asked if I wanted to read texts together, there was no real thought process before I said yes. The decision to record this podcast the way we do was risky. We don't have a script. We don't pre-talk things. We are thinking together live. And it is my hope that precisely because of that, you feel invited to think along with us. Because everyone needs a Hevruta. And if you don't have one, I hope you will let us be yours. If this way of being in relationship to biblical text speaks to you the way it speaks to me, I hope you'll help sustain us through Patreon at whatever level makes sense for you. There are some nice perks if you need them. Liturgies, videos, monthly discussion groups. This year I've added some recordings of the chanting of these texts that you might hear in a synagogue. Or you can just support us to show your appreciation and help us know that this work matters. Thanks for listening and for supporting us however you can. Is there anything else you would like to raise up from this first section?
I don't think so. Let's see what happens next.
Okay.
Or in fact, 16 verses later.
Yes. Okay. So then the narrative lectionary skips us forward to verse 24. But in those days, after that suffering, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Bobby, this is the Son of Man. This is the one you've been, I feel like, bringing into our reading.
Yes.
Right? It's this guy.
Right. This image, the Son of Man here, the human one in the Common English Bible, is drawing on that image that I keep talking about from Daniel chapter 7, who comes from the heavens on a cloud to claim dominion over the world. This is him.
Yeah, this is him.
One of the things that I do love about your emphasis on the Son of Man being human is that when you hold both of those together, like, this is the same previously human body handed over to other humans and killed, resurrected, and now comes on the cloud from heaven. And there is no disjunction between those. So I think I've been persuaded by our conversations that to think of the human one as Jesus, as a human in his earthly life, suffering the way that we suffer, and then the human one, here, the heavenly figure from Daniel 7, coming in power and trying to hold those two reference together at the same time. I don't quite, like, I can't unfold all of that, but it seems so important to me that the same way of referring to Jesus was about his suffering and death and also about his coming on the cloud.
No, I love that, Bobby. And you said something like there's no... no gap between it. Like, it's the same title, the same person,
right,
the same figure. And also in terms of like history and what's going on in the cosmos, there really is a, there is sort of a gap.
Yes,
like,
yes,
something has happened.
Yes, yes.
Things have really, really fundamentally changed. So
yes.
Now, you know, earlier we were talking about, okay, fine. The buildings of the city are going to fall down. Maybe the temple. We're not sure if that was referring to the temple in particular. And there's going to be earthquakes and famines, and there's going to be war.
Right.
These are all things that we have seen in the course of human history.
Right.
And they are extreme.
Yes.
But they happen.
Yes.
Some of these things that are described here in verses 24 and 25 are more extreme, I think.
Yes, so very much so, yes.
Are there particular references in your mind or resonances to imagery in the Hebrew Bible that these verses evoke for you, either in what they're undoing or what they're quoting? Or
you might have to fill in some of the gaps for me, Amy, in terms of specifics, but this is very familiar, sort of the day of the Lord type of imagery when God arrives in the Hebrew Bible, and that creation itself responds, that sun goes dark or the moon turns to blood or these kinds of things, the lights blink out, that in some texts, the skies like roll up like a tent. You know, there's a sense in which creation itself kind of comes undone when God arrives. And to me, this very much evokes that idea that this is God in the person of the Son of Man here coming, and creation as we have known it is coming apart.
Yes.
Would you point to particular images?
I mean, I will say what came to my mind was, yes, that sort of similar idea that comes up a couple of different times in the prophets that really feels like an undoing of creation, like the first acts of creation. Yes. And so it almost, this I don't think is in Mark's mind, but it reminds me too of the way that in some of the wisdom literature, like the presence of the sun and the moon and the sort of bigness of the cosmos and our smallness. I mean, I'm thinking mostly of Qohelet.
Yes.
That's the standard. Like the sun and the moon are doing their thing and you can work out all your human drama all you want, but that they are the sort of eternal steadies.
Yes.
Here. And so if we thought before that the buildings of Jerusalem were the steady orientation.
Oh, yes, I love that.
And then Jesus is like, no, that's not it. Maybe you would look then to the natural world and then you get famine and earthquakes. Maybe then you look to the cosmic world and that's falling apart too.
Mm.
Like the level of undoing everything you've ever known.
Yes.
It's a very thorough job.
Yes.
It's a very thorough job.
Now, mentioning Ecclesiastes, you reminded me of that line in chapter 1 that says a generation goes and a generation
yes.
comes, but the earth will stand forever.
That's right.
And here it's maybe not so much.
Right.
And now I see what you were saying at the beginning of our conversation about the Cal Vahomer. And sort of, I was making a distinction there between the Romans and God, but I don't think you even need to do that any longer. It's the sort of destruction that we're used to in human terms is nothing compared to the unraveling of the cosmos that's going to happen when God shows up. Regardless of who's responsible for the destruction of the temple.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is a whole other thing in kind, which I think helps you understand why Jesus was like, look, if people come along and say, I'm he, like, or you don't need to ask for a sign because you will know, right? Now that we know, like the sun goes dark, the moon blinks out, the stars start falling, and here comes Jesus on a cloud, that's the end. And so you don't need to wonder if this is it because you will know that this is it. At least that's how I'm reading it now.
Yeah. Bobby, did you watch the movie, I think it's from the 90s, The Truman Show? Maybe it's from the 2000s.
Yeah. The Truman Show. Yeah, Jim Carrey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where it's like, so the basic plot is there's this guy who's like living his life and he's just living his life. And it turns out that his whole life has been a reality show. So like everything in his world is a set and everyone in his world is an mm-hmm. actor,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't know.
Right.
Like he thinks this is real. It's really very tragic.
It is very tragic.
So I had not thought about that movie in a very long time, but something about this, the totality of this, of like the entire world you have ever known is
yes.
just being rolled up and it's not, it was never as... There's always been something else. Like the Son of Man is like the director, you know, is like saying that's over. That scene is over. And
yes.
something else has happened, but you never knew that there was anything bigger than this world that you
yes.
lived in.
Amy, I really love that comparison. And where it's taking my head is to this idea of, you know, of social constructivism that we get from mm. sociology, like Peter Berger and that group of folks who talked about the fact that human beings always live inside of a world constructed for us by language and symbolism, that we're being encoded into us from the time we're born. And so we're given a way of thinking about the world that we just assume is the way that the world is. And so if you grow up, you know, in America, you think like an American and
right.
the world functions in these ways that we assume is real, but in fact is constructed. And so now the way you're talking about the Truman Show is making me think, I mean, I really love the possibility of reading this undoing of the world, not as a natural phenomenon exactly, but as a crumbling of the social constructions of the world that we've been given, that we think are the real world.
Yeah.
And then here they come falling apart, and there's something else that's coming in its place. I don't know that Mark had that in mind. I think he probably really thought about the world.
I don't think he saw the Truman Show.
Naturally falling apart. But the idea that like you're a Roman citizen and Rome has told you this story about Rome and you think it's the way the world is. And now look, it's crumbling. I like the possibilities of that.
Yeah.
The thing that I love here is that when the Son of Man or the human one comes, his fundamental action is an act of gathering, right? So the world has kind of convulsed already under human structures, wars and famines and so on. And now that thing it's coming apart altogether because God is sort of re-entering. But this is not, at least in my reading, a God is destroying everything image. This is a God is gathering in from the destruction the people that God embraces. However we want to read that, the elect or the, I don't know quite what we do want to do with that term. But that I really love that, like Jesus or the Son of Man is showing up as one to like gather the chicks, you know, like protect the ones that are his to protect.
I love that so much, Bobby. And I had skipped right over it, but this is not the Son of Man. It doesn't announce that he comes in judgment.
Right.
Yeah. He gathers.
He gathers. It's not stated here how many he gathers. And so maybe there's an implied judgment, but of course, my reading
of... But it's not the focus, at least.
Right, it's not. And my reading of Jesus, you know, very much influenced by somebody like Karl Barth, is that Jesus was always about the business of trying to bring outsiders in. And so if Jesus is the one who's going to gather, Jesus is going to gather as many people as possible. And so I like to read this through that lens.
I like that a lot. Okay. Picking up in verse 28. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey, when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. In the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. Bobby, I wonder if there's anything in particular you might want to note about the fig tree image here. I mean, we've had a fig tree already in Mark. Did we read about the fig tree this year that he curses?
I don't think we read that text. Yeah.
We read that text.
I myself would not read this fig tree in light of that fig tree, even if we had read that text.
Yeah.
Which he's using as Jesus uses that fig tree as sort of a critique of the temple and the centralized religion.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think the image is a little more simple. It's simply like in Israel, there's basically the winter and the summer, right? The wet season, the dry season. And you can tell when the winter is almost over because you start to get these figs coming into fruit. And so it's not yet summer. It's not yet the time of the fig harvest, but you know it's here. And so I think he's just using that simply as an image of, you know, the time is coming. You're still in the middle of winter, but you can see this other time here, the signs are there. I think that's all he's doing. Would you say something more or different about that?
No, I think that's probably right. That it's just, you know, they live in a more agriculturally aware world than I do, even within the city of Jerusalem.
Yes.
And so you would be, you would look at the tree to know,
yeah,
you know, and get some idea of when you're going to have fruit. So it does seem more like a simple, there will be signs that will give you a hint that it's coming. And that's all you're, that's what you're going to get. Like, you're not going to get, I can't tell you it's going to be on this day or, or whatnot. But if you remain aware, there will be signs in the world.
Yes. I think that's exactly right. And there will be signs even while it yet still seems like you're in an enduring winter. And so you might lose sight of the fact that there's another season yet to come. These signs are there to remind you that this season does not last forever.
Bobby, I'm struck in this, in verse 30 and 31, all this language of passing away and what will pass away and what won't pass away. And some of it, I don't know if it's a repetition of the phrase pass away sort of for poetic purposes. Mm-hmm. I read the first part, this generation will not pass away until these things have taken place, just as saying this is going to happen in your lifetime.
Yes.
Right? It's like a fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. And then heaven, but then if you put that together with the next sentence, you get heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So you wind up with sort of this generation and Jesus's words, like chilling in the undone creation.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right? Do you think, I mean, I really, it's just the repetition of pass away that keeps, that makes me want to put all those things together.
Sure. Yeah. No, it is a very, yes, they're all connected, but it's not entirely clear exactly in what way they're connected. You're right about that. I do think that Mark, or Jesus in Mark, is saying here that the generation that Jesus is talking to will not have all died before these things take place. Mm-hmm. I think in the context of the Gospel of Mark, this is good news about the war with Rome, is that they're like in the middle of this thing that is happening, it's coming soon, it's coming quickly. Jesus also had said earlier before the Mount of Transfiguration in that text we read that, truly, some of you standing here today will see these things when they happen. What you do with that as a Christian 2,000 years later, mm-hmm. when it has not happened yet, is not entirely clear to me. And maybe the point here is that there's a sense of urgency in all times. This is that, which is where it ends, like stay awake. Mm-hmm. But I think Mark was expecting something that didn't happen in the way that he expected it, or else I don't understand what he was saying. One of those two things. Yeah. The question of, so the heaven and the earth will pass away. I'm reading that as we were talking about earlier, like the world will come undone. Mm-hmm. The thing you can rely on is the words of Jesus, and maybe by extension, the word of God, which we talked about in Isaiah 40. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether they're floating in a formless ether or whether the heaven and earth have passed away and a new heaven and earth has come into being. That part is not narrated right here, but it's narrated elsewhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I tend to read it as the world you thought you lived in is going to pass away, and what you've got left is the world of the word and of the words, which is your true home or something like that.
I like that true home language, because part of what I was thinking as you were talking was that if the heaven and earth is going to pass away, and you imagine that at least some of the generation will continue and, you know, Jesus's word or the word of God will endure, it really does, you know, like I at least pretty closely associate my life with heaven and earth. And if the world is ending, it seems to me the obvious thing would be that I am also ending. Like I don't have a way. I don't know of a way to exist outside of the world.
Right.
But this is saying there is something after heaven and earth pass away. And in fact, you may be around for it. Some from your generation will.
Yes.
That's a pretty profound reorientation.
It is very profound. The way that you have said it there is exactly right. We've been talking along the way, you're reminding me about the kingdom of God. And one of the ways that we have talked about that is it has a present reality even here and now when Jesus is walking around in his earthly form. And then it has a fullness of reality when Jesus returns here as the Son of Man. And those are not exactly the same, but they are related to each other. So you've got sort of a foretaste of that world that is possible to live in now, as we've been talking about. And it will be fulfilled later. And so that idea that if you could find your way out of the world that is given to us by the empire and live in the world given to us by the words of Jesus and the word of God, that doesn't fade away.
Yeah.
It actually comes in to being even yet more so. And that's the hope, I think, is find your way into that world.
Yeah. I feel like you have sort of begun to answer my next question in some ways. But, you know, they asked, the disciples wanted to know, when is this going to happen? And we get a very concrete here, you know, I don't even know when it's going to happen.
Right.
But there's this beware, keep alert.
Yes.
But it doesn't come with an imperative. It doesn't come with instructions about what to do.
Right.
Like, it doesn't say once you see this coming, go build an ark or go, you know, put blood on the lintel of your doorway or go do, like, it doesn't tell you what to do. It says just, it doesn't. So that's I'm so struck by this imperative, like, be ready. But what do I do?
Right. What does ready mean? What does alert mean?
What does ready mean? What does ready look like? What am I ready for?
It's a good question, Amy. I was thinking the same thing, actually, as you were reading it. And sort of the most wooden way of taking it is just like keep staring at the sky and until you see Jesus on a cloud. Which
then
I
what
think
do you
is,
do when you see Jesus on a cloud?
Right? You like wave your arms?
It is.
Like,
put on your shoes? Like, yeah, I, you know.
Because you're going to be gathered. Yeah. Amy, I think I'm probably reading this through our conversations about Matthew last year, which maybe is not exactly the right way to do that, but it's sort of where my head is right now. And in that text, we were talking, remember that text in which people get gathered into the wedding banquet and then somebody gets kicked out because they're not wearing the right clothes? And we talked about you've always got to be wearing your wedding clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we interpreted that as meaning living the life of the kingdom of God, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I'm reading Mark here. And I am not entirely clear whether I'm simply transposing Matthew into Mark because I don't know what else to do here,
mm-hmm.
or whether that's what Mark has in mind. But this sort of idea of, I mean, Jesus has sent the disciples and he's told them how to live and told them to live in community and rely on other people and teach the good news of the coming of God and baptism of repentance. And so do that, live the life to which you have been called. And we get sort of close here with the household
the
leaders,
of the house, yeah.
Each one having a job. So it's not that they're all supposed to be at the window, like peeking out to see. In fact, I think the homeowner would probably be pretty upset about that if that's all they
did.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
So do your job. And the job has been sort of implied throughout this gospel, mm-hmm. I think. And so make sure you keep doing that. So when mm-hmm. Jesus shows up, you'll be ready.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I get to. Do you get someplace different?
No, I think that's good. And that last turn of phrase you just used, Bobby, made me think of some of the ways that we've talked about the Torah in the prophets, for sure, and maybe also in some New Testament texts. But this idea that, like, y'all, God has told you what to do. What do you mean you don't know?
Like, yes. Right.
You know what it is. It's just, it's a lot. It's complicated. It's hard. It's countercultural. It's, you know, all the things. And so I wonder if, as you were talking, I was just thinking that, like, I'm asking, what are we supposed to do? But you're exactly right. Like, what do you mean? What are you supposed to do? The proverbial master of the house is coming. And you want to be doing the things you're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
Don't be lazy.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we just read in the previous chapter that legal expert saying, what's the most important commandment? Like, that question is, what am I supposed to do? And the answer was Torah, love God, love neighbor. That's what you're supposed to do. It's not that hard. You're right, in that one sense. But what it entails is
Both not that hard and really hard. That's why we keep asking the question over and over again. Yes, like there's going to be some other answer to it. Yeah.
But it's, at least it's not unclear.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I feel like this sort of naturally leads us into closing remarks, but I wonder if there's anything else just from this section that you want to hit on first.
Amy, I feel like this is one of those texts where there's always more that you could say about it, but I think we have said what we need to say for today.
Yes, we have offered the reflections of this moment in our lives on this complicated text.
It was a complicated text.
Okay, zoom out. What is something that is rising to the top for you from today's reading?
Amy, I will tell you that I am not naturally an apocalyptic person. I teach at a Methodist school, and Methodists often have a sort of social gospel kind of approach that I really like a lot. That if we all just loved each other enough, we would eventually transform the world into something approximating the kingdom of heaven. And I really, really want that to be true. The older I have gotten, and maybe the more cynical I have become, I've come to think that maybe that's not actually the way that's going to happen. And in order for the world to be set fully right, it really is going to require some kind of dramatic reintroduction of God's reign in the world that's going to result in the undoing of the world as we know it. And I sit really, really uncomfortably with that. But, you know, Jesus was talking about wars and the rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes. These are signs of the changing of the time. And here we are 2,000 years later, and those have constantly been signs in human history since then and for centuries before then. And so I think it's easy to get frustrated and to feel impotent in living in a world that is constantly coming undone. And the birth pangs never actually seem to produce new life in any sort of meaningful way. And so for somebody like me who really wants the world to, you know, I want to hold hands and drink a Coke and everybody gets along and it's beautiful. Aww. I just made a reference to a 1970s TV commercial, which maybe says something about me. But this question of like, when's it coming? To me is such a natural question. And for Jesus to say that question has no discernible answer. Jesus even says, I don't even know.
That's right.
And so why would you think you should know?
Yeah.
But then the result of that is not therefore just throw up your hands and think, there's nothing to be done. It's stay alert and keep loving God, loving neighbor, carving out the kingdom of heaven as best you can in the here and now, because you never know. And I've tried to teach my students, I teach a little class on the book of Revelation that sort of comes out in a similar place, that you can't transform the world in the way that this text envisions the world being transformed by God, but you can transform your immediate context in some real and tangible ways, even if it's just a tiny little community that reaches out in unexpected ways to unexpected people and tries to live a life of justice. And that's not nothing. Like, that is something, and it's something profound. I often wish that the world could be something other than what it is, but I have learned to live, I think, with the trying to make it better in my immediate sphere and living in the hope that in fact, something like this, where God shows up or the Son of Man shows up and gathers the people and a new life is born. I hope for that, but I've learned to sort of live not expecting that that's about to come tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I've got for today.
Mm.
What are you thinking about when you read this text, Amy?
I am thinking about the question that I said at the beginning of the episode, I had scribbled down in the margin of a piece of paper. What do we do when we think the world is ending?
Mm, yes.
And it's, so this is similar in some ways to what you are saying, but maybe a little more for those of us who are inclined to want to give up on things and just say like, well, this world is a disaster. And there's actually nothing I can do to meaningfully change it. And I think it would be tempting to read an apocalypse like, yeah, the world's a disaster and it's actually going to end. So all the more reason to start disentangling from it and care less about it.
Yes.
Your investment should not be in the world. Right. But your investment should not be in the world as it is.
Yes.
But I feel like this text offers a sort of parallel investment that is meaningful in our world here and now, but it somehow is letting me like move past my like Eeyore sensibility that like everything is just doomed. Like, so why even bother? Because it's saying, yes, there is truth in that.
Yeah.
And still, your job is to, like, the best that you can live out the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do. Like, you just have to keep doing that. And yes, you're right. The world is really a disaster and maybe it's going to end as we know it. But that doesn't mean that you should step back from it, which would be exactly my first impulse.
Yes.
Would be to step back from it. That's a pretty powerful thing.
It is.
Yeah.
Also, I like thinking of you as an Eeyore.
My favorite, there's some like, I don't know, meme-y version of Eeyore that's like his friends, the little, you know, little pig guy and the bear.
Piglet, yeah. The bear guy.
He's so hungry.
Who the whole everything is named for.
Okay. Yeah, that guy. They like go to Eeyore's house and Eeyore's basically like, yeah, I'm depressed and I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't want to talk about anything. And I thought, why would I go hang out with you if I don't want to talk to you? And they're like, that's cool. We'll just sit here. We don't have to talk. And
that's so nice.
Lovely.
Yeah.
We're just going to sit together.
Aw.
Well, you feel, like, you can feel your feelings, Eeyore. That's okay.
Yeah. I did not think the apocalypse was going to lead us to Eeyore. But there we go. Don't be an Eeyore. Be a piglet.
Are you next? Yeah. Bobby, next week is Palm Sunday.
Yes.
The Palm Sunday text.
At least the Palm Sunday podcast.
The Palm Sunday podcast, yes, depending when you're listening to this. So we are first going to circle back. We've mentioned a couple times that we skipped ahead. We're going to circle back to Mark chapter 11 to read of Jesus' entry. And then we're going to read some from chapter 14. About the anointing at Bethany.
I'm really interested to talk about those two texts together because they don't naturally fit together, but I think they might.
Somebody, a Christian person who I don't know very well, came to our concert last week and told me that it was anointed. And then me and my mamalas sat around being like, what does that mean? I mean, I think it's good, but I don't know what that means in this.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Blessed by the Holy Spirit, I think, is how I would probably read that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I guess. Yay.
Yeah, congratulations. No, that's good.
Oh, Bobby, thanks for taking me through the Martian apocalypse.
Yes, I love the Gospel of Mike.
It's good stuff. Mm,
yeah.
All right, y'all. We'll talk again next week.
See you next time, Amy.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. If you've enjoyed this free podcast, we hope you'll help us keep it going by joining our Patreon for as little as $4 per month. You can also sign up for other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced and edited by Bobby Williamson. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby, and our theme music is The World at Large by Dano Songs. Many thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping make this podcast possible.
Next week, we have our Palm Sunday reading. The narrative lectionary gives two options, Mark chapter 11, verses 1 through 11, or Mark chapter 14, verses 3 through 9. We'll discuss both. Until then, keep on digging.